Well, I'm glad to be here. Everybody else has got a chance to get up and give their testimony, so I figured, okay, I got to do this too. I like giving my testimony, but the thing is that it's always changing. You know, everything is always different. So when I sat down yesterday and started going through, you know, I had written it out a couple of years ago. We did it in our Thursday night class, and I wrote it out. And during that time, I had, you know, ages and dates and all that stuff. Well, I sat down and I said, well, that's not right. That's, you know, because everything had changed. And it's amazing what God has done even in that 2 or 3 years since then, you know. So all praise and glory go to him. Two things, guys. First of all, this testimony is not about me. It's not about how good I am, how bad I've been. It's about the goodness of God. Okay? It's about what he's done with this lump of clay and how he's used it in a mighty way and how he's actually taking all the mistakes and all the good things that I did in life and put them together and made something beautiful. Only God can do that. So all the praise and the glory and the honor go to him. Okay? Just so you know, this is not about me. I don't want any accolades. I don't need clapping. I really don't. I just want God to be glorified in this and to let you guys know what he has actually done for me, because it's been wonderful. And I've been a bonehead in my life. I've really done some stupid things. But God in his mercy and grace saw past that and saw something better in me that I didn't see. And he's still doing a work in me, and I still haven't seen all that he's going to do yet. Okay, but I know it's going to be good because he's good, and he's faithful, and he's true, and he's honest, and he'll do amazing things with if we just give him the opportunity. If we just say, Lord, I'm yours, just take this lump of clay, do something with it. So let's go to prayer. Father, I thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to gather here tonight. I pray, Lord, that you give me strength of speech, strength, clarity of mind, that you help me to remember the things I need to speak and how to speak them, Lord, in the right way with a loving heart. And also, Lord, that you will be glorified in all that is done. So when I finish tonight, Lord Jesus, people will be looking at you and not at me and thinking about how good you have been in my life. And I just thank you for the opportunity, Lord. Give me strength, courage, peace, all the things I need right now. Anoint me, Holy Spirit. I need you and I want you. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Now, I don't want this to be a history lesson. I'm a history major, okay, in school. And so I love history. And so I could in 1922, we started, you know, and I could get into those things. But we're not going to do that. But I was born in Norwich, Connecticut, 18 September 1959, 65 years ago today. This is my 65th birthday. And Keith was my brother. Bonnie, we have a sister, and then our folks, mom and dad. I'm sorry? Did I say was my brother? Okay, Keith is my brother. Family of Keith. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, keep me on the straight and narrow here. Keith is my brother, still. And I was born in Norwich, Connecticut, actually, at Backus Hospital, and I went to Griswold Elementary, and Connecticut is weird. They've got weird laws, and we lived in a borough. It's called a borough, not a city or a town, called Jewett City, but it's a borough of Griswold. So if you look on the map, you'll see Griswold, and then you'll see Jewett City and a few others all around it. It's a British thing from, you know, the 1700s or early 1700s. So anyhow, but I lived there until 1971, and I went to VBS. We went to Baptist Church when we were kids, and it was, from what I remember VBS. I loved VBS. There's, you know, the people that do VBS, you do a good work, because I still remember that, and it's one of the few things I remember from before about 10 or 11. I really don't remember a whole lot before then. But I remember one time we had a guy come, and he was speaking in tongues. People were speaking in tongues. And they asked me to do that, too, and I was scared to death. I didn't know what to do, you know, and everything else. But I went ahead and did it, you know. And I know that I accepted the Lord. My mom said that I accepted the Lord when I was at that church. I don't remember it, to be honest. You know, I was so little. I don't remember what age or anything, but she said that I did do it. But I don't know if anybody else has ever experienced this. between our house and Jewett City and the Preventures, which is the house next door. There's a little walkway through the woods right there. And I remember one day I was walking that, and all of a sudden it's like I came aware. I can't explain it other than all of a sudden I could just see and remember and think. And it's like, oh, wow. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's almost like I was in a fog before, and I didn't know it. And I don't know if there's anything to that. I'm just telling you, this is what happened to me. And it was like, wow, okay, I could understand and think clearly, and everything. And I remembered things. Before that, I remembered just tiny bits and pieces. I really don't remember a lot of my childhood before that particular time, just tiny, tiny little bits. Some people come up, when I was three, I did this and I did this, and I remember going here with my, and I don't remember a lot of that stuff. But it was a time when I woke up, and I wonder to myself if that was like a spiritual thing, because I was about 10 or 11 years old when it happened, and I remember I just thinking to myself, like, wow, I can understand, I can think, I can, you know, just. There was a clarity that I can't explain, but it's almost like I woke up then. But we lived there until 1971, and our dad got a job at Vermont Yankee, which is a nuclear power plant in Vernon, Vermont. And so we moved to Vernon, Vermont, and when I was 11, and I went to Brattleboro Union High School. And Brattleboro Union High School is not a good school. It's one of those schools where everybody goes, you know, from all the towns, because it's so small in that area. And so everybody went there, and it wasn't a good school. And I hated school. I hated school. It wasn't that I was dumb or anything. It was just that I hated it so bad I didn't do well, because I didn't even want to be there. You know, I just wanted to get out of there as soon as I got there. But while we were living in Vermont, we started attending a community church for the first 2 years that we were there. And then we went to a different church called the Vernon Advent Christian Church, which is still the church my parents are going to right now. As a matter of fact, 50, 60 some odd years later, I don't know, from 71, whatever that is. But they're still going there. They're still, dad's an elder, and mom does things with the church and stuff. But it was a church that had a youth group, and it was a guy named Mike Gant, and in that youth group it was called the New Life Singers, and Keith and I were part of that, and there was about 30, 40 of us, boys and girls, and there's more girls than boys, which was my dream. Anyhow, but it was a group, and we would go all across the East Coast. We had a bus, and we would tour on the East Coast and stuff like that. We did that two or three times. I remember we went up being on tour on that bus. Oh my goodness, long, long hours of traveling on a school bus the first year, and the next year was an actual diesel bus. But that was a tough time. But during that time, I had some great moments. Now, we're singing Christian songs, okay? And so you would think that I would be on fire for God, and you know, and we portrayed that when we were on stage, you know. But you know what a hypocrite is, right? A hypocrite is an actor, right? I was acting the part. I was like, yeah, yeah, oh, I love God, yeah, yeah. But deep down inside, I didn't really know him. Didn't even really know if this was right or not. Now, there was a few times where God really touched me, and I felt like, oh, man, I accept you, Jesus. I love you and everything else. But then I would go on and do my own thing afterwards, you know. So I don't know whether or not I was actually saved during that period of time. And I'll explain to you why in a little bit. But we went there, and then I actually rededicated my life on one of the tour. But I went my own way. I mean, I was into the drug scene. This is the mid-70s. Motorcycles and girls. That was my three things. And even though I was in church, I did these things, and it just didn't feel real to me. And so I did that until 1977, when I graduated from high school. And our dad is from Montana. He's one of those old, you know, when as soon as you graduate, you're out of the house, you know, type thing. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm working in a grocery store bagging groceries. Okay, not a lot of call for that on the outside. Plus, what am I going to do as far as I couldn't afford an apartment or anything like that? So we had a guy in our church named Ed Rice. And Ed Rice, actually in the community church, was Ed Rice, had two beautiful daughters. Anyhow, I went and saw Ed, and so we looked at jobs and everything else. Oh, and before that, when I was getting ready to graduate from high school, Dad and Mom sat me down and says, "So what do you want to do?" I says, "I think I want to be a pilot. You know, I want to fly airplanes." And they're like, "Great. Okay, there's something called the New England Aeronautical Institute in Nashua, New Hampshire." And so Mom and Dad checked into that, and it was a very expensive school, especially for the 70s. But when I would graduate, I'd have a commercial pilot's license and a private pilot's license and be instrument certified. So I could go to Delta, United, any of those, and start working right away. But I had never flown, guys, never been on an airplane, but I'm going to be a pilot. Okay, so I remember one day we were down in Springfield, Massachusetts, doing something, and on the way back in Amherst, there's this little tiny field, airfield, and they had glider rides. And so my dad said, there was a billboard and it said glider rides $20. Dad says, "You want to take a glider ride?" I'm like, "Yeah, well, that'd be great. That'd be fun, right?" So we get in there, and we get up there, and we come back, and when we land, I am green. I mean, I'm green. I'm like, "Oh, I don't feel good," you know, because he was doing stuff like this and, you know, everything else. And I knew he was doing it just to mess me up, but it messed me up. Well, we hit the ground. We get in the car and we start driving back. And so Dad says, "So you still want to be a pilot?" And I'm like, "Oh, no, I really don't want to be a pilot anymore. Not after that. I don't want to do that all the time." I was like, "Oh, no, what am I going to do?" My folks had already put a deposit down on this school. And it was like $2,000, $3,000. It was a lot of money. And so I'm like, "What am I going to do?" And so when I got home that night, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, and I thought of Ed. And so I called Ed Rice, the recruiter, the next day, and I says, "Hey, you know, can I go ahead and sign up?" Went down there, and he says, "Well, what do you want to do?" I says, "Well, I don't want to fly them, but I'm still interested in planes." So I says, "I want to work on them. I want to work on the big ones so I can work for the airlines and work out there and work on the engines and the planes and everything else." He goes, "Okay, great. I'll make you an aircraft mechanic." I'm like, "Perfect." So I went home, and I remember the hardest thing I ever did in my life, guys, that was one of the hardest anyhow, was sitting down and telling my parents that I didn't want to go to college because they had put all this money down. They had made all these plans and everything else for me to go. But, yeah, it was one of those like, "Oh, what are you going to do?" And, of course, our dad, I don't know if you heard Keith mention our dad. Our dad loves us, no doubt about that. But he's kind of a tough guy. He's a strict guy. He was raised by his dad, who was a lumberjack. You know, he's just that kind of a guy. And so I was scared to death of my dad. And I was like, "Oh, no, Dad is going to just lose it when I tell him," you know. So Mom's sitting at the kitchen or at the sink. Dad's sitting at the table. I sit down. And I said, "Dad, I got to tell you something." I says, "I don't want to go to college." And Mom dropped a dish. You know, she's like, "What? What do you mean you don't want to go to college?" And Dad was calm. He goes, "Good." He said, "I don't think you would have made it." He says, "You just didn't have the heart for it, you know." He says, "So, but what are you going to do? Because you can't stay here once you turn 18. And that was September 18th in 1977. I says, "I'm going to go in the Air Force. I already talked to Ed Rice, and I'm going to go in December. And so he says, "Okay, you can stay for 3 months, but you have to pay rent here at the house until you can go in the service." So that's what I did. So anyhow, I joined the service, went to basic training in Texas, and went to Shepherd, which is in Wichita Falls, Texas, for training, and then got stationed in Loring, Maine. This is in the very top of Maine. It's called Caribou. It's if you look at Maine, it'll go to the upper right corner. That's where I lived, guys. And you talk about a cold, miserable, remote place. But this is in the 70s now. This is during the Cold War. Okay, so we had nukes. We had bombers with nukes and tankers and everything else up there, plus silos and everything else up in that area. So I about froze to death up there, I swear. I mean, it was really a miserable time. But during that time, while I was there, I met Peggy. And Peggy's was the woman I married back in. And I met her in 1980, and we got married in 1981. Shortly after we got married, she wanted to start going to church. Well, I hadn't been going to church. I wasn't interested. I was still smoking pot. I was doing drugs and stuff, you know. And in the military, as an aircraft mechanic on nuclear-tipped bombers, You know, I mean, the grace of God, guys. The things I should have not gotten away with, the things that I should have put me in jail or destroyed my career or whatever, God in His wisdom or His mercy or grace or whatever you want to call it, kept me from getting caught. I don't know how or why, but I'm glad He did, okay? Because it changed everything for me, because I did have a future in the Air Force because I was never caught. But I attended a Baptist church off and on with her. Now, she was serious about this. My walk was kind of blindness. I grew up playing church. You know, the church that we attended we played church. You know, we sang some songs, we sat down, we read the Bible, the preacher gave a 20-minute message, and then we went home type thing, you know. I mean, we played church, and that's kind of all I knew, and that's kind of all I understood about God, was that you know, we just play this game. But Peggy was a lot more dedicated and faithful than I was, and I'm glad she was. But after the 5 years up there, I was up there. I cross-trained, and I cross-trained to combat arms training and maintenance, which is basically a weapons instructor. I taught people how to shoot guns and mortars and rockets and all those things. And I was an armorer. I fixed guns. I fixed them and, you know, repaired them and got them back on the road. And so from there, I went to Castle, California, which is in Merced, or Atwater. It's between Fresno and Sacramento. It's in that area right there, Modesto, really. I was there for 3 years, but during that time, I didn't attend church at all, and my lifestyle was not good, guys. It really wasn't good. I was just kind of doing my own thing. And yet, through the grace of God, through all this time, God never gave up on me. You know, I mean, I look back now, and I think of things that should have happened to me there that didn't happen to me there. Like getting caught or whatever, you know. But God protected me in miraculous ways. But while we were there, our daughter Erin was born, and that was in 1984. She's 40 now, lives in Holly Springs, North Carolina. And then right after 3 years, I got stationed in Spokane at Fairchild. And there, our son Matthew was born in 1996. And he lives in Denver, Colorado, as a matter of fact. And then I have two grandkids, Jack, who's 16, and Annie, who's 13 now. But while I was stationed there, I got there in the middle of a snowstorm, in the middle of a blizzard. I'll never forget this. And we got up there, and it was just one of those things where I thought, man, what have I got into? I'm going from California, guys, back up to where I was in Maine again. You know, it felt like anyhow. But I was there for 6.5 years, and they made me NCOIC of the Combat Arms Unit, which is a non-commissioned officer in charge. But I struggled during that time with rejection and overcoming it. And the reason I say that is because I didn't have a good self-worth during this period of time. And the reason I believe for that is several things. But one is that I always wanted acceptance by my dad, but I never felt like I really got it. Does that make sense? You know, like no matter how hard I tried, it didn't really matter. He was still angry with me about something. You know what I'm saying? And I always, I guess without realizing it, pictured God the same way. You know, when they say God the Father, I pictured God as being that kind of a God, you know, is that He's ready to smite me as soon as I mess up. As soon as I sin, He's going to get me, you know, and punish me, and it's for my good, you know. And it was hard, a hard thing to battle, but because of that, I had a very low self-worth. Well, God gave me this very difficult, I mean difficult, boss while I was there. His name was Warren Grogan. He's passed on, so I can talk about him now. But Warren was a Christian, okay, with a foul mouth and a very mean attitude. Very, very, just mean. He was just mean. That's all there was to it. And, of course, he's the guy that I report to, and he's always giving me garbage and always giving me garbage. And I was there for 6.5 years, and about 5.5 years in, I finally got the gumption or the courage or whatever to stand up to him. And one day I remember we had a blowout in the office, and I'm screaming at him, and I'm yelling at him. You know, 5.5 years or so worth of anger came out during that time. And I remember when I got done, he just kind of looked at me like, whoa, what have I done, you know? And he treated me completely different from that point on. because I wasn't going to take his crap anymore, all right? He wasn't going to walk all over me. He wasn't going to belittle me and everything else. And shortly after, it couldn't have been 3 months, he got orders and got shipped out. See, that's a God thing. He was doing something. You know, we have people called sandpaper people in our lives. And we talk. He talks about it, about how these people, they kind of rub us the wrong way, right? But that sandpaper is actually, you take it to a rough piece of wood, and even though it may be scratchy and everything else, when you get done, the wood is nice and smooth, nice and soft. And God does that. He takes the rough edges off us with these people, guys. I know it's hard when you have a bad boss or a hard boss, but God is doing it for a reason. It's not a mistake. It's not a, like, oops, I gave Warren to Bruce. How did I do that? God knows everything that's going on. And he did it to grow me and to help me out during that time. But while I was there also, Keith was over here at Fort Lewis, and then he got out of Fort Lewis and was living in Tacoma, okay? And I was trying to remember the other place that you were at over there. Didn't you buy a house? Graham, that's the one. Well, during this time, guys, I'm partying, okay? When I'm in Spokane, I'm partying, I'm carrying on like I always do. Didn't really do anything other than the pot and alcohol, but I did that, you know? And Keith and I would get together, and we would come over here. I loved coming over this side of the state, okay, from Spokane. It was like a 5.5-hour drive, 6-hour drive. It was a long drive. But we come over here, and my wife and the two kids, and Heysook and Judy, they would go off and do things, and Keith and I would go fishing, or we'd go do whatever, especially fishing. I remember Stellacoom and kind of catching power worms and almost drowning out there in that little boat. Yeah, we just would do these things. Well, I was drinking, partying, and carrying on. Well, during that time, Keith got saved. Okay? And I remember the first time he came to Spokane, after he got saved, I went out and I wanted to smoke a joint, and Keith's like, no. I'm not doing that anymore. And I'm like, oh, man. You know, there's no fun in doing something wrong if the other person's not going to join in. You with me? Right? Because you want them to, misery loves company. Well, so do drugs love people that are doing drugs, right? You know, because that way, my conscience is appeased because, hey, everybody's doing it. It's a good thing, right? So the thing is that, but Keith was different. And I was like, man. You know, man, this is a bummer, man. My brother, the one I really loved getting together with now, he's not doing this anymore, you know, and I'm really bummed about it. Well, during that period of time, we had started off and on to go to a Baptist church in Medical Lake, Washington. And we went there several times, and my wife, again, Peggy was more dedicated to it. She would take the kids a lot of times, and I wouldn't go. I didn't want to mess with it. But during that period of time, they had a men's group, just like we have a men's ministry here. And in that men's group, they had a camp out one night. And at church, when I would go to church, I always had the kids with me. Okay, they were little. They were, you know, toddlers or, you know, 5, 6, 7, that age. But I always had them with me. And they did the altar call after every service. You guys know churches like that, right? And so they would do this altar call, and I was like, oh, I can't go up. I got the kids. You know, what am I going to do with the kids? Oh, I can't go up. And, I mean, I used that excuse several times. I don't know how many, but several times. And anyhow, it's getting warm up here. So what happened was one Sunday, Peggy took the kids into the nursery, and it didn't dawn on me. I mean, God made me blind to it or something, right? And I remember sitting there, and yeah, good service, good sermon, you know, and everything else. And I felt that tug, but I'm like, well, I've got the... Oh, no, the kids aren't here. Oh, no, what do I do? But I felt the tug. I felt the Lord saying, come home. And I was, I think, either 28 or 29 years old. And I'm like, oh, Lord. Okay. So I went up, and I was bawling like a baby. And I really gave my life to the Lord then. And there was a change, guys. There was an absolute change within me. That you can't describe. I couldn't get enough of the Bible. I couldn't get enough of prayer. I couldn't get enough of just talking about Jesus. So I knew there was something different. There was definitely a change in me then. And so, you know, so and what happened was the guys, when I got saved, they came and they pulled me over afterwards, and they said, "You're not going to believe what happened." They said, "Last night we had a camp out, and in the camp out, we all gathered together and we specifically prayed just for you, just for your salvation the night before." And they're like, "We're just floored." Because I wasn't a hard nut. I was a stubborn little cuss, you know, and I didn't really want to do this and everything else. But because they did that, it made a difference, guys. And something changed. God orchestrated things just right for me to get saved. And I'm so glad he did. I'm so glad those men prayed for me. So never give up on prayer, guys. Never give up on that, because it makes a difference. It changes things. It truly changes things. So we started going to the medical lake, and during that time, I finally went in, like I said, and got saved. But I was still playing church. Please don't get me wrong. I am not slamming Baptists. I was a Baptist for many, many years, okay? And they did some good things. But there was not a spiritual awakeness that we have like we have here, okay? It was the routine. It was the religion, okay, during that time. And guys, you can't live in that religion and expect to grow and expect to really blossom and just, you know, come apart. Some people maybe, but for the most part, I get into this rut again. And if you're not growing, what are you doing? You're dying. If you're not going up, you're going down, guys. There's no straight and level in the spiritual world. You're either growing or you're going the opposite direction, I've found. You can't ride the fence. A lot of people try, but you can't do it, guys. Because when you ride the fence, you end up going down eventually, you know. So during that time, I went ahead and started getting a little bit colder. But I was going to church. I was playing the guitar on the praise team, and I was doing all the things. I even taught the youth for a little while, and, you know, I was doing stuff like that. But it really was starting to get kind of cold in my heart, and I didn't realize. I didn't have a good spiritual walk with the Lord, because it didn't really stress that. As long as you went to church, you're good to go, right? And I gave my life to the Lord. Once saved, always saved, right? You with me? Okay. I've since changed my mind on that, but that's another story for another day. But in 1992, after Warren Grogan got thrown out, this new guy came. Well, he was the guy that assigns the places where you go, okay, for all in the world. And he had that job for a number of years. So he had all the contacts. He knew who had a contact and everything else. He gets there and he says, "How long have you been here?" I says, 6.5 years. He says, "Don't you want to go anywhere?" I says, "Yeah, I want to go overseas." I says, "I've been putting it in, and nobody will do anything about it." And, of course, this is shortly after Warren now. And he goes, "Okay." He says, "Let me make a phone call." So he made a phone call, and he comes back and goes, "Would you like to go to the Azores?" Well, guys, I don't know if you know where the Azores is, but I didn't then. Okay, it's a group of islands about 800 miles off the coast of Portugal out in the Atlantic Ocean. And what it is really is a big refuel stop for airplanes. And what we do is when we fly our fighters can't go all the way to Europe nonstop. They have to be refueled. And so what they'll do is they'll fly us like halfway to the Azores, and then a tanker will refuel them, and then they'll fly to the Azores, and they'll stop. They'll do maintenance. They'll fill them back up again, and off they go to Europe or wherever they're going. So that's what this was. It was a little tiny island called Terceira. It was, I think, it was 8.5 miles long and 3.5 miles wide. It wasn't a very big island. But I was there for 2 years, and I liked it there. I really did. One of the best things was I had to do what they call a remote. And a remote usually is 1 year, Korea, or someplace like that where you can't take your family. You got to go by yourself. Well, in this case, the Azores, I had to sign up for 2 years, but I could take my family. And so I took the wife and kids with me to the Azores. So I didn't have that time where I was away from my family for a year, which was really great. And I loved it there. During the time there, I found a Baptist church again and a tobacco barn. And I mean, it was a tobacco barn. It still had tobacco in the corners. I mean, it was just a concrete walled place, you know, and we put some chairs down, metal folding chairs, and that was our church, you know. But during that time, I kind of got cold spiritually again. I just, even though I was going to church, it just wasn't it just wasn't changing me. It wasn't really doing anything for me. I did get a University of Maryland degree in small arms training and maintenance, which that 50 cents to get you a cup of coffee. But I also built a range inside a volcano. We actually built a rifle range. I got pictures of it. I actually got them in my desk, but pictures of it. And I won NCO of the Year for SAC, for the Strategic Air Command. That's a huge award, guys. And I'm not boasting. What I'm saying is to make this point, even though I had that, all that stuff, I really wasn't happy or satisfied. It didn't really do anything for me. I never really fit in with people because even though I was cold spiritually, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't chase women, I didn't do any of that stuff. You know, I was trying to be a good family man during that time. And so basically what happened was I felt like an outcast. I felt like I really wasn't a part of anything there. I think that's why I tried so hard to get that award from my commander, to please my commander. See, I was in that performance mode, and I still get in that sometimes. The Lord gives me a good quick kick sometimes to get me out of that. But I found myself trying to please others, either my boss or my commander or whatever. But then I got orders to Seymour Johnson, North Carolina, and I had been in about 16 years at this point. And then I went to I was down there, and I went to a church while I was there in Medical Lake, or I'm sorry, not in Medical Lake, in Goldsboro, and it was a huge Baptist church, 2,000 member church, and I remember we were there for 2 years, and one day every time the pastor would have everybody greet everybody. You know, hi, how are you? You know, welcome and everything else. Okay. I've been there 2 years. The guy turned around and says, oh, welcome. Have you filled out a visitor card? I said, I've been going here for 2 years. I even played up on the stage before. And, oh, well, I'm sorry. I don't know who you are. And I thought, wow, you know. So I'm not into big churches. I'll just be honest with you guys. That kind of turned me off to it. I like smaller churches where you can know folks and everything else. But so what happened was we went there for a couple of years while there was a huge church split. And it was really ugly, very ugly. I mean, I literally watched a church split in front of me. And I hope I never see it again. And it turned me off. I'm like, I don't want nothing to do with this. Well, we found a CMA church, a Christian Missionary Alliance church, like the one up the road, there in Goldsboro, and we started going to that. And I started playing on the praise team and all this stuff, and I taught some Sunday school, and I was doing all these things, but even during that time, guys, I was kind of getting a little cold spiritually, even though I was going through all the motions, because I didn't have any quiet time with the Lord. I wasn't reading my Bible all the time, wasn't praying all the time, I wasn't doing anything to kind of feed my spirit. And so my spirit is getting cold and dying, and I'm thinking I'm good to go. And I think a lot of people are in that mode. A lot of people are in that place in their life. And that's a scary place, guys, because if you die during that place, I just wonder. I'm not going to say what happens, but I just wonder. And I don't want to be in that place. I want to know with certainty that I'm where the Lord wants me to be. I'm in His will. I'm doing what He asked me to do. And I'm just going to go ahead know that I'm safe, that if the Lord takes me now, if the Lord comes tonight, guys, and He can, by the way, while I'm talking, if the Lord comes tonight, I know I'm going, okay? And that's not boasting, that's just confidence in my spirit that I am a child of God and that He lives within me, His Spirit lives within me. I've given my heart, soul, mind, strength, everything to Him, and Lord, I'm yours. Take me, use me, however you see fit. So, during that time, I also went to college, and I knew I was going to retire. Well, small arms training and maintenance, not much of a career choice when you get out. You know, what'd you do? Oh, I taught people how to kill other people. We'll call you. You know, I mean, there's not a lot of call for it on the outside unless you get into law enforcement. Well, I was going to be 38, 39 years old, and the cutoff in all the police departments was 37 or 38. Depending on where you were at. So I couldn't get into law enforcement. So I'm like, now what do I do? So I went to a technical college and got a welding degree. And so I went to school and got a welding degree. And so I had a skill. So I had a skill set when I got out. And as a matter of fact, I had a job lined up. I had 60 days of what they call terminal leave. And I went ahead and I retired on a Friday that Monday I went to work as a welder. Okay, that quick. And so I'm being paid during that 2 months, plus I'm, you know, starting a new job. So things were going okay there. But I was there for about 1 year, and then they had me working. It started out 48 hours, okay, and those were some long days. But I thought, okay, I can do this, you know, 38, 39, I can handle it. And they got young kids working with me, right, that are 20s, whatever, prepping metal and everything else, because I was a pipe welder. And I was doing that for about a year. And by the end of the year, they had me up to 60 to 70 to 80 hours a week. I was working 7 days a week. I was making money hand over fist, but I couldn't spend it on anything. I bought this beautiful Chevy 3/4 ton extended cab, you know, pickup and everything else, and a camper. But I couldn't go anywhere because I was working all the time. So I finally gave him an ultimatum. Said, guys, you're killing me. I can't do this. Well, it's production. And in production, if you have a production job, you have the more you do, the more they want. Okay, and you can't win. So anyhow, I quit. It's the only job I've ever quit in my life. And I went to work for a construction company that belonged to a guy that went to our church. And I was a backhoe operator for 3 years. And I dug footings and did flooring and things like that, a lot of concrete work. And then that company that I was working for that 1 year called me back. They said, listen, we want you to come back. We'll give you a pay raise. You'll only be able to work 40 hours a week. Okay, I'm liking this, you know. And you'll be in the test house, so you're going to do research and development. I'm like, perfect. So I went back and I started working for them. Well, on March 30th, 2007, guys, and this is what, 17 and a half years ago, I was a motorcycle rider, loved to ride, and I always loved to ride. Well, I was up in the mountains of Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina, and we were going through the twisties, and I was going too fast. And I was pushing myself too hard to try to keep up with the guy behind me because I had motorcycles behind me. And back then, we didn't have GPS, so if I got lost, I had no idea where I was. So I'm pushing too hard, and sure enough, I go around the corner, bike goes down, lands on my leg, and it flips me up, and I land back first at about 30 miles an hour to this huge boulder. I just hit the rock and bounced. They said I bounced off the rock. And I had the full Kevlar, full face helmet, everything. I broke the helmet in half. Okay, didn't affect me, but you know, but I broke the helmet in half. And I remember that they just took the chin strap off and it just fell. And so I'm laying there and I'm like, oh, in such horrible pain. And I can't describe it, but I couldn't feel anything from here down. But pain. All I could feel, I couldn't move hands, feet, nothing. But just everything was completely shocked. And so they flew a helicopter in there because we were way up in the mountains. Flew a helicopter in there, got me down there. Long story short, I broke my back in two places. I burst fractured one, and I broke the other one in half in my back. Broke my tailbone, cut my leg from here to the front to the back where I hit that boulder. There was a sharp outcropping. And I broke my left leg in places. I've got a rod. It goes from my knee to my ankle because I had a compound fracture. The bone was sticking out in my leg. And then I broke my ankle and my foot. So I messed myself up. All right. Now, during this time, I'm laying in bed. I want to die. I don't want to live. Okay, because they're telling me you're not going to walk anymore. I was paralyzed, guys. Now, eventually I got used to my hands again, but from the legs down, nothing. And I wanted to die. And I prayed. I said, God, let me go home. Take me home. I repented of my sins. I said, Lord, I'm done. We're good to go now, you know, and everything else. Take me home. I don't want to be paralyzed. Please don't do this. And so we were there. I was there, well, 6 weeks in that one hospital. But after about 3 weeks, I remember the nurses come in. They give you that sponge bath. And she came in and she gave me a sponge bath. And when she was doing that, she goes, oh. And I looked at her and I says, what? She goes, wait. She went like that. She goes, oh. She said, your big toe just moved. That's huge. Because that means that she was stimulating my foot and it was reacting. I didn't feel it, but she saw it. And she said, no, your toe definitely moved. And over the period of a couple of weeks, the swelling had gone down, and all the surgeries that I had and everything else, the swelling had gone down, and I started to be able to move things. Well, everything had atrophied. I'd been sitting in a bed for, 6 weeks, and then they moved me to a spinal rehab in North Carolina, over on the eastern side, closer to home. And I spent another 6 weeks there learning to walk. And during this time, I'm crying out to the Lord, and I'm confessing. I am praying to Him. I'm reading my Bible. I got nothing else to do. I mean, God took me to a point where I had nothing to do but watch TV or read the Bible or pray. Okay? And TV gets old quick when that's all you've got, And so I did that, and I started to come alive spiritually again. And I remember, that as I learned how to walk and everything else and transition, I had to go to a wheelchair. I was in a wheelchair for almost 6 months, and then I went to a walker, and then finally went to a cane, and then finally without. But this was all over a period of 2 years, and during that time, I thought, well, I'm better now. Let's find a job. Well, nobody would hire me, guys, with my injuries. Nobody would even look at me because I couldn't stand for long periods of time. I couldn't walk a lot. I was literally needed kind of a desk job, and there just wasn't anything available. And all I had was an associate's degree in small arms training and maintenance. So what happened was I went back to school and went to GI Bill, went ahead and got my history degree. Now, I thought I was going to work in a museum or teach history or something like that. That was my plan. That's what I thought I was going to do. But God had different ideas with that history degree. And it was still a good thing. It wasn't a waste of time or money. But I couldn't find any work. And during that time, my marriage with Peggy was falling apart. Our kids had graduated high school. We homeschooled them. They graduated and went to college. And so we got the empty nest. Me with all these horrible injuries, and she's taking care of me, and it got really bad. It got really bad. And I'll just let it say that during this time, I made some mistakes. She made some mistakes, okay? It's always a two-way street. It always is, guys. It's never just one person, you're the problem, even though she would tell me I'm the problem and she's good to go, all right? But if you don't see your own self and see your own mistakes, okay, you can't have a marriage that way, guys. You can't. All right? Because the two have to be one, and you're split. All right? And so what happened was I was, during that time, I was in a bluegrass band, and I did that for 3 years. That kept me sane. I believe that was a God thing. We sang Christian songs, a lot of bluegrass Christian songs. And we toured around the North Carolina and stuff like that. And it was fun, but I was getting discouraged, very, very discouraged. And I don't know if depression is the right word, but discouragement definitely is. And so during this time, I was miserable. I didn't want to live anymore. I really didn't. I couldn't find work. Our marriage is on the rocks, and it was like we were living in the same house, but that was as far as it went. And Keith knew my situation. In November of 2010, he says, I want you to come out and I want you to visit. So I hopped on a plane and came out here, and I was here for about a week, maybe not even that long, and I knew this is where I was supposed to be. Have you ever had that time in your life where you just knew this was the right thing? And that was me when I came. No job lineup, no place to live, okay, no income, all right, other than my retirement pay from the military, but I had to give half of that to Peggy so she could live, because we had our house and it was paid for and everything else, so she had a way to get by, and she just had to get a job. But I was like, I know this is where I'm supposed to be. And I remember I went home and I told her, and boy, that was a rough 2 days, because I had to load the car by myself, and I was actually sleeping with my gun, if that tells you anything. That's how scary it was. It was a bad time. And I took off and I went to Vermont. In Vermont, I was addicted to OxyContin from the surgeries and everything else. They'd given me so many pain meds that when I quit taking them, I was sick. I was awful sick. So I took them just so I wasn't sick, but they weren't working anymore. They were just keeping me from being sick. And so my mom, our mom is an RN. She got me off the stuff. I remember about 3 or 4 days, I didn't see things and I didn't, you know, hallucinate, but I felt horrible for about 2 or 3 days and then finally got off the stuff. That's why I don't try to take any kind of medication whatsoever if I can help it. But anyhow, Keith had me come out here, and then I spent 3 months in Vermont because my daughter was going to have my granddaughter, Annie, in March. And so when she had Annie, I drove down to North Carolina and then came out here in March and, you know, skirting storms and everything else. And God got me out here. Do you guys know who Nels and Jennifer Honeycutt are? Okay, most of you do. Nels and Jennifer had this garage that they had converted into an apartment that they were going to rent to make some money. Well, they said, oh, Bruce can come in there, and they wanted $600 a month. Okay, now I came here with $850 a month to my name. All right, I want you to do the math. I had a $300 car payment, $50 or $60 for insurance, okay, and gas, food, whatever, okay. You do the math. It doesn't work. And yet, in their grace, in their mercy, they said, just pay us what you can. And sometimes it was $25. I mean, it was nothing. They weren't making any money on it. But during this time, they had a store, a sporting goods store, and they were doing okay. And so they're like, don't worry about it. When you can, just pay us. You know, and it's okay. And for 3 years, guys, for 3 years, I lived there. Well, after about a year and a half, I've been coming here for this whole time, still looking for work, can't find work, cannot find work. And I know that was a God thing, because otherwise I may not have taken this job. Clifford was the guy that was here, and Cliff had to leave. And then I remember Keith told me, he said, would you be interested in being a clerk? I says, well, what is it involved? I've never been one. I don't know if I can do that or not. And, you know, files and maintaining money and things like that. And I says, well, I can try, you know, I'll give it my best shot because, man, I needed something, you know. And it's been perfect. It's been a perfect job. All those history things that I learned, you know, cataloging, coordinating, files, all that stuff, worked perfect for this job. I mean, it was just right, guys. It was just right. And even how to write papers and things like that, you know, it just worked out just right. So I was doing that. And then after a year and a half, Nels and Jennifer started falling on hard times, right, almost within a couple months of when I got my job here. Okay, so I started paying them, all right, during that time, and that kept them going. They ended up having to sell the house, and the people that bought it let me stay there and stuff like that, but I kept paying them, all right, extra every month because I wanted them to, you know, help them during that time. And they needed that money to survive. They really did. She went back to school. And that's how God provided. And they said, "This we wouldn't have made it if you hadn't given us that money. We don't know what we would have done." But you know how, according to the law, that was wrong, right? Because I was freeloading off of them. I wasn't paying them rent. But according to God, it was okay. And I, you know, and he worked it so that they helped me and then I got to help them. And I got to help them until they got on their feet again. And then I moved into town and I moved outside of town for about 6.5 years and then moved where I'm at for the last 3. But, I now live in an apartment. I like guitars. Okay. I like guns. I like cars. You guys know that. Okay. I think I'm on my 5th car since I've been here. And I collect coins. Those are my favorite things to do. But my walk of faith, guys, which is so important to me and it should be to you as well, is that I have played on church praise teams for 20 plus years. And I've never had the joy that I have when I get to play here because Keith and I have a bond. You know, when we were on that New Life Singers group, we had a bond together that works so well. And, he doesn't turn around and go, you know, do this, do that, or whatever. I just kind of can tell by his body language, oh, we're getting soft here. Oh, we're going up here. Oh, we're, you know, and oh, we're getting ready to stop, or whatever. And the Holy Spirit has bonded us that way, united us that way. And so that when we're playing, it really is the Holy Spirit guiding us, guys, and directing us. It's not just Keith and I and our talent. It's the Holy Spirit using us in conjunction to make a beautiful sound to the Lord. I taught the youth here for 2 years. Okay, that is not my calling. But God had me do that for 2 years, and he got me through it. All right. But I guarantee you that's not my calling. All right. But, you know, you step in when the Lord says, I want you to do this. And I was like, Lord, really? Man, this is not cut out for it. But he did it, and it worked out just fine. I've taught the Thursday night Bible study for several years now. I think three or four years now it's been going on. And God's given me the grace and the mercy to teach. You know, I do not feel like I am worthy enough or capable enough to teach the scriptures to others, especially adults. Okay? You think about it. God is going to hold us more responsible, according to the Bible, for the things that we say and do, especially as a teacher, as a pastor. And so, to me, that's a huge, not burden, but a huge responsibility that I don't take lightly. And so I try to pray up, and I try to study, and I try to do my very best. And the Holy Spirit has always, always, always come through. I don't know how many times I've gone home and said, man, how did you do that, Holy Spirit? Sometimes I wasn't as prepared as I wanted to be, and yet it went perfect. It went great. And yes, you have bad nights. Let's face it. And I go home, Lord, do you still want me to do this? And then the next week it goes fantastic. And I'm like, okay, I'll keep doing it. You know, but we have those times like that. But I have enjoyed doing that class. And I just pray that the Lord gives me more opportunity to do that. I'm no longer willing to play church, guys. Time's too short. Time is way too short. You guys can look around you and see what's going on in the Middle East. You get into prophecies and everything else. You're going to know we are at the last gasp here. I believe the Lord is calling His final remnant together. I'm not setting dates. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but I am going to say that it's going to happen soon. And what soon, according to God, could be 10 years, right? But it's going to happen soon. And I just have this sense, you know, we see the fruit on the trees and it's getting ripe. It's almost ready to pick. So I'm thinking, wow, something's going to happen here really soon. So be willing or be ready at all times, in season and out of season, to not only give your testimony, but to be where you need to be with the Lord. You know, when we mess up, and I mess up all the time, when we mess up, I go right to the Lord now. I would love to say every single time, but almost every single time now I go straight to the Lord and say, I messed up, Lord. I screwed up. I can't believe that guy cut me off, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that I could say what I said, you know. Okay, forgive me, Lord, you know, and get me on. But I also want to be on fire for God. And my goals, literally, my goals here are I want to serve Jesus any way that I can. Anyway, especially in music and in teaching, because I think those are the things that God has kind of give me as gifts. And so I love being the clerk. I love serving the Lord here. It's been a wonderful 11 plus years. And I just can't wait to see what He's going to do next. But I also, like I said before, want you guys to be ready. Be ready, because something may change very quickly that may affect all our lives. And how we deal with that is going to depend on where we're at spiritually. If you are cold and dead inside and you're looking good on the outside, trust me, when things happen, and things are going to happen, guys, persecution is going to come, you're not going to last. You're not going to hold up. But if you have the Spirit of God, doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter. The Spirit of God is more than able to get you through whatever is coming our way. And we are going to come out victorious. Remember, we win. In the end, we win. I keep telling myself that, even when it looks bad and everything else, eventually we do win. We may lose some wars or battles on the way, but we win the entire war, you know? And our God is faithful and good that way. So thank you for letting me share with you. I hope I didn't go on too long and bore you to death. Did you guys have any questions or anything, Rick? We were about, Keith was probably 10. It was in Vermont. Oh, I thought, well, we were in Vermont. Did you? Okay, I don't remember that. I remember being in Vermont and you showing me how to do some chords and stuff like that. But I was probably about 11 or 12 when I started, and Dad bought me this big club of a guitar. It was a Sears in Roebuck. Guitar, okay, so you can, you know, quality at its best, right? It was $20, right? Now they're worth a mint. I wish I'd kept it. It was a club. Dad says, you learn to play that, and I'll take you down and let you buy a Yamaha. And at the time, in the 70s, that was a really quality guitar. And so I learned how to play it, and I remember he took me down and did it, and then I was hooked. I was playing guitar. I didn't play in any bands, other than off and on. Some I'd fill in for certain things. When I was in the Azores, I played in a country western band. That was unique. I'm not a real country western fan, but hey, they needed a guitar player, and it's easy to do. So, you know. All right. Thank you guys for letting me share. And.